Well, let's get proceed with, I guess, we'll start, wanted to hear the bill first, so let's go get, have Matt come up here and then do their overview, and when we get a quorum, I'll have you guys stop and we'll take the bill up, it should be real quick, and then we'll go from there.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and we were asked today to come before the committee and provide you with kind of what we would call a MAC 101 review of the commission, because, honestly, we find that it's difficult to kind of keep track of all these various extensions of government, and MAC is particularly interesting for folks because it's a long-standing commission, one of the first commissions, if not the first commission created by the state legislature. And we think that kind of going through a little bit of our background history helps orient the members of the committee. So if I might, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is just basically start with an overview of the commission, and I'll just talk until you tell me to stop.
Mr. Hamill, why don't we do this here? Now that I've got a quorum, why don't we get our business taken care of that we have to, and that way we can get...
Should I stay here, Mr. Chairman, or should I go sit? What was like?
Why don't you let the Representative Welty come forward, and we'll get back to you.
Very good.
Now we've got a quorum. Representative Welty and Representative Scalzi, would you move?
I'll move House File 269 for discussion.
Okay. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scalzi. Members, House File 269 is a pretty simple bill. All throughout this past summer and leading into the current session, we've been hearing from local units of government about different mandates that they either want reformed or eliminated. And in this case, this travel policy was brought forward in 2005 by a current member, and I have spoken with that current member about the modifications that we're making, and essentially that current member is neutral on this bill. What this bill does is, with the current travel policy that's in place, it just says that the local unit of government must have a travel policy in place, but we're taking away the requirement that it has to be reviewed annually. This appeared on the Association of Minnesota Counties list of mandates that they wanted reformed or eliminated, and other local units of government have brought it up as well. So I'm moving this one forward as a good government policy, showing that we're extending our hand out to local units of government, we're not micromanaging, and that we still like the travel policy in place, but it does not have to be reviewed annually. And with that, I will ask my counterpart here to identify himself and state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I think Representative Welty did a great job of explaining the bill. AMC fully supports this. This is just one of many proposals that we're currently working on. We think, as you said, it just kind of streamlines things. This just eliminates a little bit of busy work and hopefully allows our folks to focus on some more productive things in their county. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm also here in support of House File 269. We fully support the requirement of state law that a formal out-of-state travel policy is adopted by each local government unit, but we agree with the author that an annual review of that policy is simply unnecessary and a needless occupation of time on board agendas each year, and I consequently believe that this is a needed reform of one of the many mandates to which we're subject.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to inform committee members that this bill took about 90 seconds in the Senate, and it's already on the consent calendar in the Senate, so it's up to you and, of course, the body here as far as do you want to submit it to the consent calendar in the House, or do you want to roll it over in an omnibus policy bill?
Thank you. Any questions from the members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a full point of clarification, Representative Welty, is if this were to become law, would there be any thing that would stop a local government or county to or school district from reviewing their programs on an annual basis?
Representative Biskins, Mr. Chair, the answer would be no. They could review it whenever they want. And as you notice with the current bill, in case you don't have it before you, anytime they change a policy, within that travel policy, they have to take a vote. And it has to be public.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification, Representative Welty. That's how I read it also. And, Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the first baby step towards elimination of mandates. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. Mr. Chair, just for the committee's knowledge, or maybe if you've thought this through, is it your intention to gather all of these hopefully plethora of mandate reductions that we're going to move forward this biennium and roll them into one bill, or is it your desire to move these out one at a time and have potential Christmas trees built on the House floor?
Representative Biskins, originally my intention on this bill was to hang on to it and make a bill, you know, instead of having the same questions asked 100 times on each one of them, to do one, but seeing how this one's already on the consent calendar of the Senate, I'm thinking of moving this one out for now, and the committee, there's a working group that's working on with Representative Marquardt's committee that Representative Lanning is chairing, that's working on mandate relief with the counties and the local government. So I'm looking forward to a bill coming forward from them, and they said they think I'm going to let it run separate.
Yeah.
Representative Biskins.
Final question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in this new committee structure, is it within the purview of this committee to send bills directly to the House floor, or does this bill have to go up to the higher committee, the State and Local Government Operations Committee?
Representative Biskins, it has to go up to the to the office.
Thank you.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Matthews or Mr. Carlson, could you give me some notion of what an annual review would consist? It seems to me like this is something that would not necessarily be time-consuming or resource-consuming to do in the first place. Is there some prescription somewhere about what the review has to be, or...
Mr. Matthews, Representative, what has happened currently is this ends up on a consent agenda somewhere in most counties, and I think you're right, this by itself does not consume a huge amount of resources or time, but we have a number of these that we've identified that when taken together, we're really starting to clog up our staff time and our board meeting time, and we really think that in this case, we don't know that there's really a benefit to the public from just having that annual review, which has really just become, as I said, more busy work. There's nothing here to prohibit the county board from bringing this issue up if they feel it needs to be addressed. But we think that this, taken in conjunction with a number of other proposals being heard in Representative Lanning's working group, will really help us find some more productivity and efficiency within counties. And, you know, like you said, by itself might not seem like a lot, but taken in whole, we think that this is some of the things we just need to start addressing.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Matthews, is it correct to assume that, I mean, this is just talking about the travel policy, is it correct to assume that at some point in budget considerations, the travel expenses would be reviewed in any case?
Mr. Matthews.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, yes. The county boards, as they set their budgets each year, do review all of their expenses they go through in the normal annual budgeting process and as they set their levies. So they are looking at that, and I do know in my conversations with county administrators and other county board members that they have looked at what their travel is, et cetera. And I think, again, as Mr. Carlson indicated, it's good that they have a policy in place so that their employees know what is and is not permissible. But they clearly, in this current economic climate, have looked at that. And, you know, that's more of a budget-setting process that they go through, separate from this kind of ongoing policy that's in place.
Thank you. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering why the exception for towns, is that something you looked at to address, to take that exception out for political subdivisions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, to my understanding, I think the towns are accepted primarily because they're so small. I don't think they do a lot of out-of-state travel. I think at the time, and I wasn't working for counties in 2005, but my understanding is that it just really wasn't an issue on that level. There was more concern with schools and counties and cities, which were larger entities that might have been traveling out-of-state more frequently. That's my recollection.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Pelfis, do you want to say something before? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members, just in further answer to Representative Hilsey's questions, with regard to review of those policies under the current economic situation that we find ourselves in, I'm aware in our membership we have adopted a number of cost-cutting measures, including basically freezes on all travel except for training purposes, in addition to a number of both soft and hard hiring freezes, extended periods that vacancies have to keep open. So it's not as if those policies aren't going forward right now, frankly, regardless of the annual review of this formal policy. Cost-cutting measures are taking place.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think any time we can reduce mandates is probably a good thing. But I guess I'm just looking at this, and it seems so incremental. I mean, what does it cost to currently to review this and to just have a motion at a county board meeting or whatever, to extend the current policy? I mean, does this save any money? I mean, I heard you comment a little bit that maybe incrementally it has some savings, but I mean, this just seems like an awful small fish to fry here in the kind of the circumstances that we're in. To be running as a special bill, you know, I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think what we need to start looking at is what we can do as a whole and take many different mandates, modify and reform them and move them forward, give counties, local units of government, more flexibility. And if we, I think, go down the road of saying this one or this one or this one really doesn't meet the requirements, then I don't think we're going to make a lot of progress. And so I think that we do need to start taking a look at many different mandates, modifying, reforming them, moving them out. It can be as a single bill, or it can be as an entire bill, you know, with all of them rolled into one. But I think that we need to begin really looking at, you know, what must we do? What must be in statute? And when I look at this, and I've heard from local units of government, they said, we have a travel policy in place. Not only that, but as it says in this bill, you have to take a vote whenever you modify or change that travel policy. Then the question becomes, well, why is the state dictating to the local unit of government that it has to be done on an annual basis? And so I look at this as one of, let's leave the discretion up to local units of government to decide when they're going to review their travel policy. Of course, in these economic times, they're going to be doing that more frequently because they're going to look at cost-saving measures. But I just believe, in the aggregate, small bills will add up. Yes, there may. You look at this, and you might not see a lot of cost savings with this, but you start adding up all of these bills by the end of the session. Hopefully, we'll have some significant savings for counties and local units of government.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Eastland.
I don't disagree with anything that you said. I'm just looking at what this bill actually accomplishes, what it actually saves, and the daunting task before us to look at the entire array of mandates out there. It's hard to understand why we're dealing with this as a bill on the table today when there's efforts to look at a lot of very, very big issues that have much bigger impact than this one. So that's just my comment. I mean, I don't disagree with this bill at all. I guess I'm just talking about process more than content here.
And Representative Eastland, some of that is from the chair is that it's we've been trying to get bills, and some of the people don't have their bills ready to be heard, so this one was ready to be heard. So And there is Representative Lanning's working group that's going on about mandate reduction that hopefully that'll come up with a more significant bill that we're going to hear later. Anybody from the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Representative Scalzi.
If not, I would recommend that House File 269 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. I'm not sure if I've got the title right, but I think it's close.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
And Mr. Hamill, thank you for your patience. And
fine, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to the committee and provide kind of a background as to what the Metropolitan Parks Commission is and how we were created and what it is that we do and some of the issues that we think you should be aware of as we begin the session. First of all, thanks for your time today. Appreciate the interest in the MAC and what we do. By way of background, the Airports Commission was created in 1943 by the Minnesota State Legislature. It was the first commission created by the legislature and has operated as an independent airport authority since that time. Our primary responsibility is to promote air transportation and to support air commerce in the seven-county metro area. And that needs to be explained a little bit. Our jurisdiction is actually defined in statute as a 35-mile radius from City Hall downtown Minneapolis and City Hall downtown St. Paul. So you have two overlapping 35-mile radius concentric circles over one another that kind of define our area. As a result, it includes all the seven county metro area plus bits and pieces of about five or six additional counties. We own and operate seven airports in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. Of course, the obvious one is the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. We also own and operate the St. Paul Downtown Airport, listed as an intermediate corporate use facility. The Lake Elmo Airport on the east side of St. Paul, which is a recreational, small, basic utility airport. The Anoka County Airport to the north, Crystal Airport in Crystal, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center. The Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie, and the Air Lake Airport down in Lakeville. The system of airports in the Twin Cities is the third or fourth largest airport system in the United States. From the standpoint of all seven airports contributing to aircraft operations as well as passenger activity. Our job primarily is to provide a safe and efficient, convenient, environmentally responsible organization that provides aviation services for the Twin Cities. And I think when we finish talking in a few minutes, you'll understand the economic impact and why we think that the Airports Commission provides important service to the community. We are governed by a board of 15 commissioners. The commissioners are appointed and or recognized in statute to sit on our board. Of the 15 seats, 13 commissioners are appointed by the governor of the state of Minnesota. They serve for four-year terms. The two other remaining seats are the mayor of Minneapolis and the mayor of St. Paul. Neither mayor personally serves on the board at the present time, but have appointed representatives in their place. And all of these terms are they're overlapping. So in other words, we don't have a complete transition or turnover of our board at one time. And what that does is permit us the ability to maintain policy continuity and to not lose the knowledge and the background experience of our board by having a complete turnover transition with the election of a new governor. We also, from a financial standpoint, receive no state taxes or financial support from the legislature. Our primary function here is to be responsive to your needs, to keep you abreast of aviation issues, and to come to you to answer questions you may have regarding issues relating to the operation and management of our airport system. We generate our own revenues, and as a result, that's how we pay the bills of the commission. We charge the airline companies our fees and rates and charges. Those fees and charges that they pay, plus investments and expenses met by the traveling public, the users of the airport, are how we generate the overall revenues run our system. The Airports Commission's annual operating budget is about $252 million a year. 45% of that comes from revenue generated from our concessions program. Concessions being the food and beverage and retail sales in our terminal building. 36% of all of our income comes from airline rates and charges. We charge all the airline companies a fee to land on our runways based on a rate per 1,000 pounds of landed weight. We charge the airlines to park their aircraft on the ramp at the gates. We charge them a fee to lease the gates. We charge them a fee for the holding area and the gate lobby area. They pay common use fees for the concourses and the terminal square footage. They pay us for their office space, their ticket counters, their mechanics quarters and so forth, their equipment rooms. They pay us for the baggage carousels and so forth. It sounds like we charge them just about every way they turn, and in fact we do. But even with all those rates and charges, Minneapolis-St. Paul ranks in the lower half of the nation's largest hub airports as far as overall cost to the airline, a measure we call cost per plane passenger, which is an overall cost to the airline company to process one passenger through our airport to depart the facility. 19% of our revenues come from a variety of other sources, such as bonds, passenger facility charges, other sources of revenue. As far as statistics go, Mr. Chairman, members, Minneapolis-St. Paul is the 12th busiest airport in North America in 2007. Today we're the 14th busiest airport in the nation as far as overall passenger traffic goes. That's a dramatic shift from a few years ago. By way of showing, I'm going to explain to you the volatility of this industry and how it dramatically shifts. It's very much like a roller coaster ride. In 2005, the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport ranked as the 7th busiest airport in America, had over 37,600,000 passengers. Today we're ranked about number 14 with just a little over 34 million passengers. What that means is in the last 3.5 years or so, we've dropped by about 3.5 million passengers in overall operations, or about 10% of our total traffic load. That is a significant decline in passengers for any airport. I should also point to the fact that given the current economic cycle, most major airports in the country are experiencing similar declines or even greater, and smaller airports that used to enjoy limited air service have lost their service altogether as part of the full economic down cycle. Aircraft operations for MSP are essentially flat this year. We don't see any significant declines, nor do we see any significant increases. We look at this as being hopefully a year of stabilization. With the recent bankruptcy of Northwest Airlines in the 2005 timeframe and the merger of Delta Airlines and Northwest Airlines, we believe that we have pretty well reached a level playing field and a stabilized point. We may see some slight decline in the next year or so, but we believe we're heading toward an area of stabilization, and then we'll see some new growth begin as the economy recovers. 52% of the passengers who travel through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport began or terminated their travel in the Twin Cities. That is, they're called what we call as origination destination passengers. They want to be in the Twin Cities. 48% of our passenger traffic are people who are connecting through the Minneapolis-St. Paul market and are only here because their flight had a transfer at this location. Because we are a large hub headquarter airport, a large hub airline airport, now we say Delta, the Delta Airlines brings its passengers into the Twin Cities, and basically they transfer to another flight to continue to their final destination. 48% of our traffic are those visitors who do not wish to be here but are here because of the travel sequence. Each of those passengers, however, still pay $4.50 of a passenger facility charge when they depart the airport to go on and finish their travel. Minneapolis-St. Paul has been a large hub airport going back in most of our history, going back to the origination of Northwest Airlines in 1926. The hub-and-spoke concept, however, first grew out of deregulation in 1978, where airline companies kind of identified key market locations and where they decided to basically install or develop and grow major operating bases. In the case of Northwest Airlines, these major hub operations are Memphis, Detroit, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. Delta's, of course, is Atlanta, Salt Lake City, a variety of other locations, Cincinnati, for example. Economic impact of the Metropolitan Airports Commission Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is substantial. I frequently refer to our 3,100-acre piece of property over in Hennepin County as the most valuable piece of property as far as revenue generation in the state of Minnesota. Last year, we generated about $10.7 billion of economic vitality to this community. We created 150,000 jobs. We pay about $626 million a year in state and local taxes. This is conducted as the result of a study conducted by Martin Associates. I'll also caution you that these numbers, while they're enjoyable to use and they point to a significant impact, I think that can be kept kind of in comparison to other numbers. And what we try to do is use the same economic analysts to do these studies for us so that, in fact, they're consistent year to year. That lets you compare the growth of the airport and its overall economic impact. The $10.7 billion may be plus or minus a billion, I don't know. We compare ourselves with other airports around the country, and depending on who does the consulting work, it becomes questionable as to how accurate that number is. But certainly the trend is true, and the overall economic impact is one that can be documented. Management of the airport is efficient. We have a very, very solid reputation around the country. We are the 12th lowest cost airport of the top 30 airports in the nation. We expect to be the 10th lowest cost airport in the nation in 2009 with some of the cuts that we've made. Zagat surveys basically identified Minneapolis-St. Paul as one of the five best operating airports in 2007 and 2008. And the airport has a long history of being recognized by the airlines and by users of the facility as a very efficient, well-managed, clean, and well-maintained airport. We have national reputations in snow removal, overall construction efficiencies, and maintaining and ensuring that we have low overall costs at the airport. From a competition standpoint, Minneapolis-St. Paul is served by, I believe, something like 17 or 18 different airline companies. We're frequently challenged and asked the question, why is it that Southwest Airlines has not served Minneapolis-St. Paul for so many years? There's been a perception that the MAC has had a policy of not seeking out and trying to solicit competition for our marketplace. But in fact, my entire 30-plus years at the MAC, we have always had gate space available. We've always been soliciting and encouraging airlines to serve the Twin Cities. And in fact, before Southwest announced new service last fall, we'd visited Dallas, Texas at least 15 times in the last 18 years, made presentations to Southwest to encourage them to start service in the Twin Cities. The bottom line is that an airline company's decision to serve the marketplace or a particular airport is purely a boardroom decision of that airline. So there will be little that an airport can do to encourage that service except to kind of make its case on overall cost and demand in the local community. The good news is that on March the 8th, Southwest Airlines begins air service in the Twin Cities. That combined with low-cost carriers Sun Country Airlines and other low-cost operators such as AirTran, we will find good competition in this marketplace, and citizens who travel from the Twin Cities will be able to find competitive airfares to more destination points than most any other airport in the nation. In fact, because we are a large hub, we have nonstop service to 144 destinations, 21 international destinations, which includes Canada. By comparison, just to give you kind of a comparative number, Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, about 3 million total people, 160 or so direct nonstop flights. Oklahoma City, about 1 million, or about one-third our size, 21 direct destination points. So if you're not a large hub, you don't enjoy the magnitude of numbers and this whole connectivity that takes place in a hub as people who start and end their travel here versus folks who travel through the market really do generate extraordinary service. In fact, there are relatively few airports in the country that enjoy better service than we do as far as nonstop air service to most every destination domestically and quick nonstop service to Europe and to Asia. We just enhanced the capacity of the airport. Between 1996 and 2005, we spent $3.1 billion, what we call the 2010 plan in Minneapolis. We basically executed numerous projects that overall prepared and positioned this airport to meet the community's needs into the 2020s. Specifically, we expanded parking in the Lindbergh Terminal building. We did a complete realignment of the inbound downbound railway system for overall improved efficiency. We added on to the Lindbergh Terminal, the city concourse, some 40 or 45 gates. We built the Humphrey Terminal building. We built the Humphrey parking ramp and expanded those facilities. We basically built the new north-south runway in the airport, and we paid for the airport's portion of the LRT that goes underneath the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, connecting downtown Minneapolis through the airport to the Mall of America. Bottom line is that our airport is now positioned to meet the projected growth demand for the future. We believe that we can meet additional growth through the year 2025 without significant new construction unless an airline company comes to the Twin Cities that basically indicates to us that they need 5 or 10 additional gates to support their operation. Only time will tell, but given the current economic cycle, we think that demand is going to be delayed a bit until the economy of the country recovers and the aviation industry stabilizes. By way of environmental responsibility, we're pretty proud of our environmental record in the Twin Cities, and I'll just be somewhat direct and simply tell you that I believe we have the most aggressive noise mitigation program in the United States, if not the most aggressive program in the world. We have to date spent somewhere in the area of $360 million on noise mitigation. That is more per capita dollars spent than any other airport in America. We have insulated nearly 8,000 private residences at an average cost of $42,000 per home and no cost to the homeowner. As you may or may not know, noise exposure is defined by a contour around the airport that defines the overall decibel noise level of exposure. The federal government has basically defined 65 decibels or louder as being that line where you live inside a noise impact zone area. If you live outside the 65 decibel contour, you are no longer included in this noise impact zone. We have to date completed the acoustical insulation of every home that requested such insulation inside the 65 BNL contour. We've also acoustically insulated 17 schools in the metropolitan community. And most recently have committed to $127 million of additional noise mitigation for homes between 65 and 60, the number decreasing as you go farther away from the airport. And to date are the only airport in the country that is committed to go out to the 60 BNL noise exposure contour. That will include, by the way, another 10,000 residences, both single-family home as well as multi-family apartments, duplexes, and those sorts of accommodations. There's a great deal of detail that I'm skipping over, Mr. Chairman, regarding the details of our mitigation program, but it is an extraordinary program that does more for our community than any other airport in the nation. We're also taking a close look at water quality issues, as well as air quality issues at the airport. All these environmental concerns are focused around the overall operation of aircraft in and out of our community. There's kind of the good and the bad of this whole impact, and that is boiling down to this. The airport is conveniently located inside the community, close to population density. That means the airport's accessible to our community without great driving distances. The negative aspect is that when you tuck the airport in that close to residential areas, you've got these environmental impacts that impact the community, and we have felt for more than 30 years that we have a responsibility to deal with those environmental impacts, and I believe we're executing that in a very superior manner. We also operate a system of reliever airports. We call them relievers for a very specific reason. They relieve the pressure upon MSP. MSP is the only airport with runways in excess of 7,500 feet, which is typically the length needed for commercial airline air service. We're trying to attempt to keep smaller airplanes that don't need those long runways and all those amenities away from MSP to preserve its capacity for the future, dedicating the MSP runways for large airline operations moving massive numbers of traveling public and passengers. What that means is that we have a responsibility to build the smaller airports in our area, the six relievers, to accommodate all the other needs of aviation users, to include corporate aviation, small business operators, as well as private recreational pilots. And as a result, we have airports designed for commercial business aviation as well as recreational pilots and small business operators throughout the metropolitan area. The idea being to attract the smaller aircraft away from MSP to preserve its capacity in the long term. Some dramatic improvements over the reliever airport system in the last couple of years. In addition to a flood wall that we've built around the St. Paul downtown airport to attempt to prevent that airport from being subject to flooding of the Mississippi River, and also an extensive drainage system that's been built to support that flood wall, we've also seen a significant expansion at the Anoka County Airport. We've recently lengthened the runway from 4,000 to 5,000 feet. We installed all-weather instrumentation on those runways to accommodate all aircraft users the ability to operate in all kinds of weather. And we've seen the investment of the county and a private operator called Key Aviation installing significant new facilities and building new facilities in the Anoka County Airport area. What this has done is positioned the Anoka County Airport as a very, very viable corporate jet alternative to MSP as far as future growth and operations, and also meets the future growth of the northern communities. On the west side of the community, in the Flying Cloud Airport, we're in the process now of expanding our runway from 3,900 feet to 5,000 feet for the same outcome, to accommodate corporate aviation use in the western suburbs, where many of our corporate headquarters are located, and there's a great substantial demand for the smaller corporate jet type of activity. Mr. Chairman, I can go on, but I think we want to get to some questions and answers the committee may have, by letting me say to you that we're pretty proud of the airport system. Is recognized nationally, internationally for being a leader in a variety of areas, specifically in snow removal and snow operations, overall safe operations. We enjoy one of the finest safety records in the nation without having a failed aircraft crash in over 50 years. The airport has a great partnership with the airlines, and we believe that we have developed and grown the airport system to meet the needs of our community. We have been recognized nationally and internationally on various surveys as being an airport that is easy to use, easy to navigate, cost competitive, and an airport that's a choice of many airline companies as far as overall service goes. With that, let me go ahead and open myself to questions that you may have regarding our airport system.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming, Mr. Hamill. To your
observation about the reduction in passenger capacity from 2005 to present. You mentioned that we had gone from number 7 to number 14. Who's filling the void? What airports, what regions are skipping up ahead of us? We're all suffering under the economy, but it's something going on that we ought to be aware of vis-a-vis these other regions or other airports.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bernstein, the answer is that nobody is stepping up. This economy has driven individuals who choose to fly for leisure purposes, big vacations and so forth, to cut back. And we can literally see a decline in leisure travel and leisure bookings in the airport, as well as business consolidating or cutting back on its flying as well. That combined with the intent of the airline companies to cut capacity because of reduced demand has resulted in all of the airports across the nation seeing declining numbers. Now, there may be a few pockets where they've not seen significant decline. I don't know of any airport, any large airport, that's seen increased traffic levels. And in fact, in 2009, it's projected that we're going to see average declines of about 10 to 12% in most major markets in the country.
Mr. Chair, but
Representative Hornstein,
seems like then there must be some regions or airports that are declining at a lesser rate. If we were 7, then you know who's 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, who's filling the void between us then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, I think what you're getting at is how is it that we've dropped 3.5 million passengers and dropped from number 7 to number 14?
Yeah.
I think we'll see those numbers begin to shift and adjust. And I'll give you an observation that is purely my opinion, and that is some of the result of our declining passenger came about because of the bankruptcy of Northwest Airlines in 2005-2006. At that time, Northwest Airlines cut some traffic activity in the Twin Cities. Then with the merger of Delta and Northwest Airlines, combined with the bankruptcy, what we've seen is this decline of passenger activity over the last 3 or 4 years. During that time period, when we were declining, other airports were basically sustaining themselves and in some cases growing. And as a result, the percentage became significant and our decline our numbers dropped. But let me also point out that there's a range of airports in this 32 to 38 million passengers a year that includes St. Louis and Phoenix and Minneapolis-St. Paul, Cincinnati, and across the country. We're very, very closely marked. So that a couple hundred thousand passenger drop would drop you a position or two each time that happened. What's happening now is that we're pretty well down about where we're just about at our baseline. I think we might see another percent and a quarter of decline. But if you read the media and look in the journals in aviation, airports such as Las Vegas, they're now experiencing significant declines of 5 and 10 and 15%, in some cases 20 and 25% in the last year and a half. So those airports are now starting to see those declines as well. And what I expect to see at the end of 2009, early 2010, is our 14th rank popping back up to 12th or 10th. Because the airports have now adjusted after we have. What's good, I think, from our standpoint is that with Delta coming into the marketplace, and with the synergy of Delta Airlines as the largest airline company in the world, maintaining Minneapolis-St. Paul as a major operating hub, we're going to see stabilization, and then we'll see some growth at Delta, and we hope to shift some of that growth in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. And I think that we'll find ourselves typically in the 8, 9, 10th ranked airport categories in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamill, I got a question ties into that. On the 28th of January, there was an article in the paper, in the Strib, regarding fewer flyers and going on about numbers coming down. And I guess the question is, that was right about the time that you were finalizing your deal with Delta. And is this going to affect the 400 flights that there are in that agreement? Are we going to be dropping below that because of the number of flyers, or are we going to remain stable in that?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. And during the negotiation process from about the middle of September until just this last week, we spent a great deal of time on some of the numbers that you find in that agreement. And the reason that we spent so much time on it is because Representative Delta Airlines wanted to make sure that they would not make a commitment to a brand new document that they would be violating or breaching almost immediately into the new year. And as a result, the number of the 400 that you know, that's a familiar number for you, or the 250 flights, the 400 flights, the 10,000 jobs, those numbers were part of a very, very serious and critical part of our negotiation process. They did not want to find themselves in a position where they would agree to some number that they would be violating within the next year, a year and a half. And as a result, I'm quite confident that we're going to see ourselves sustaining those numbers. With the provisions and accommodation of the force majeure language that you're aware of in the agreements. But I think that there was a high level of sensitivity on the part of Delta not to agree to a situation that would put them in breach or in jeopardy early in this agreement.
Thank you. Representative Skelty.
Well, this, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hamill. It's nice to, always nice to get a report from you. And my question was much like Representative Hornstein's. In fact, it was the same question, but I'm still kind of not clear why we would have dropped from the 7th to the 14th. And I'm wondering if it could be because we were so heavily invested in the home building industry. Would that have something to do with it? But that's a pretty dramatic drop from 2005, which was our high year, to 2008. I think that's significant that we dropped from 7th to 14th. And I understand what you say, Las Vegas is going to catch up and all that. It still is. It doesn't make sense. I still don't get it, why we've dropped so dramatically. I mean, it may not be a dramatic drop. It may be incremental, but still in relationship to other areas of the country. I still don't get that explanation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I would love to talk with you in about 6 months. But what we've seen basically is about a 10%, 9% decline in our traffic from our peak in 2005 to where we are today. This year alone, in 2009, I think you're going to see many airports in the country dropping 10, 15, 20% in 1 year, as opposed to 10% over the course of 4 years. In other words, I think that we were ahead of the curve from the standpoint that Northwest was confronted with bankruptcy. They were downsizing the airline at that time, and they started very, very early as part of that bankruptcy proceeding. And then with the merger of the two airline companies, Delta and Northwest, they continued to reduce capacity in the system, and we are where we are today, at levels that I think are sustainable and put the system at the bottom of that barrel, at the bottom of that baseline. And I think we're now positioned to stabilize within a percent or so, and we'll begin to see some growth over the next 18 months. Minneapolis, in other words, will be stable, I believe, over the next year, year and a half, where we will see probably 5 to 10 airports in the large hub category that will see significant declines in 2009, far exceeding the 10% that we've experienced over the last 4 years. I think the circumstances were unique in the Twin Cities, given the bankruptcy and the merger, that were not found anywhere else in the country.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking on the first page of your handout. You said that we were seventh. We ranked seventh in 2005.
Correct.
And we're 14th today. And then I was just noticing the economic impact data that you have on here is from 2005.
That's correct.
What's happened for the economic impact between 2005 and then today, and how has that affected your budget, and kind of how is that working?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman, let me explain a little bit. I've used the $10.7 billion impact because that's an economic analysis that was done in 2005. By using that number, I know that as we grew from 05, 06, and 07, and if we grew, that in fact there'd be more economic benefit to the community. Because we've seen some declining activity, I believe that $10.7 billion has fluctuated a little bit up or down, but I think it's a good number to use because it reflects an analysis that was done in the mid-2000 time frame, and it's one that we can legitimately document. What it is today, I don't exactly know. Here we are in 2009. But my belief is that it's still very close to that number, or maybe slightly lower, but it's not a dramatic decline. And what it does is provide us kind of a baseline reference for future growth and opportunity. We do not do this economic analysis every year. It's done about every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we'll have one done, I think, probably in 2009 or 2010 again to update it.
Mr. Representative Eastman.
And then just another question. You said that the... roughly 52% are the origin destination
Correct.
Flights, and the 48% are the connecting flights. Has that changed over the course of this period of time where we've seen this change in the airport?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it has. In fact, what we've seen is a shift going from a predominance of connecting traffic, about 51 or 52% connecting, 48% origination destination. It's just simply flipped over. And now what we see is a majority, 52%, are now origination passengers and destination passengers, and 48% are connecting. And what I think what that does is reflect the overall trend of travel patterns in the United States, with overall decline, primarily of business travel, long-haul, international, and domestic flights.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, and just one other thought. how do, I mean, the MAC is how we do it here. How do other major airports manage themselves? What other models are out there? Can you just kind of tell us
Dr. Hamlin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Easton, I can give you kind of a 101 on airport structure. There are basically three structures of airports. There's a residual model, a compensatory model, and a hybrid. A residual model is a financial model where the airport has a contract with the airline companies, and the airlines basically underwrite the expenses of the airport. They guarantee at the end of every year that the airport is made whole. In turn, or in exchange for that guarantee, the airline companies are given financial oversight of the airport. In other words, the airlines make the primary financial decisions on airport expansion, additional new gates, remodeling of concourses, concessions, and so forth. They make primarily those decisions and leave a relatively modest amount of money available to the airport authority for certain improvements that they would like to see done. A compensatory airport is just the opposite. A compensatory airport basically does not have any guarantees or assurances or guarantees from the airlines. The airport itself has complete and total responsibility for its financial performance. And as a result, a compensatory airport would have to calculate its various cost structures to make certain that at the end of the year it generated enough revenue to pay all of its financial obligations, because the airlines are not going to write a check at the end of the year to make the airport whole. And I would tell you that Minneapolis-St. Paul is neither of those perfectly. We are kind of a hybrid. And I say hybrid because the airfield runways and taxiways are basically a residual model. In other words, the airlines guarantee that whatever improvements and costs that we have regarding runway improvement, reconstruction, and so forth, that's underwritten and guaranteed by the airlines as a break-even. But the terminal facilities, the gates, the roadway system, the parking, the light rail transit, the concessions, all the other operations of the airport are compensatory in Minneapolis-St. Paul, where we have to charge users fees in order to generate the revenue to pay our bills at the end of the year. And if we have a shortfall, that's a deficit on the part of them, on the back of the commission, and not satisfied by the airlines. So I mentioned those are kind of the three models you find around the country. Also, you find airport structures, either airport commissions, such as Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is an independent airport authority, or you find them to be extensions of city or county government, and in two cases, Maryland and Hawaii, extensions of state government. We believe in Minneapolis-St. Paul that our commission that was created in 1943 was extremely insightful and gave the airport authority and autonomy to develop one of the most sophisticated and best-performing systems in the country.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Hamill, I just was wondering, what are the qualifications of the commission members and what kind of compensation do they receive?
The qualifications are determined by the governor of the state of Minnesota, as I think just being individuals who we believe are responsible, folks who care about the community, who wish to volunteer their time and commit themselves to making good decisions and oversight of the staff and the commission's overall operations. They are not required to have pilot's licenses or aviation or flight background, although in every commission we have one or two people who have a pilot's license or some interest in aviation. At the present time, we have a person who is the general manager of Monaco Aviation in Duluth, Minnesota, on our board. In the past, we've had pilots and we've had business owners and so forth that have had that kind of experience in aviation. But no one that's an airline pilot, no owners of an airline company, that sort of thing. As far as compensation goes, our commissioners receive a per diem of $50 per meeting, and that's it, plus reimbursement for personal expenses coming to and from meetings or if they should travel on commission business. But there's no other compensation for our board members except the chair, who does have a salary, I think, somewhere in the area of $20,000 a year. And that's been identified because of the amount of time that he personally spends dealing with the staff and working on issues in preparation for meetings and establishing policy guidelines.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Representative Hornstein.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hammer, we've visited in the past about some of these environmental issues, and we have Representative Kalin and Representative Hilty here, and I just want to focus a little on energy, which we've talked about recently. I know the airport is a major consumer of both electrical energy to, light the facility. You have fossil fuels as well, oil, all kinds of gas, both for the planes and for the vehicles. Solid waste issues with waste generation, and you've indicated that you've received some awards and made some progress and are a leader on this. Would you have any objection to maybe over time tracking some of the savings over a period of years in energy consumption, solid waste generation. I think that kind of kind of historical perspective would be very helpful to us. And again, I think the airport has shown, has made some strides. You've even said that your energy bills going down, of course, helps on the bottom line. But if you could kind of briefly outline some of your initiatives and how you intend to keep those and improve those over time, and maybe even report some of that progress to us in the future, either on an annual or a biennial basis, would be helpful.
Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Orenstein, specifically let me just refer to one of our environmental programs. We have a program that we call the STAR program at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, Stewards of Tomorrow's Airport Resources. And I'm going to give you just a little bit of background here, and that is that when you talk about environmental savings and environmental responsibility, people generally think in terms of less noise. But in reality, the environmental impacts that an airport either generates or must live within impact the entire operation of the airport and impact the community, and we fully recognize that. And we believe that in order for an airport to be sustainable in an urban, developed, metropolitan community, you can't just look at noise alone or look at the emissions of aircraft engines and operations, but take a look at the entire airport as an infrastructural part of the community. And what we've done in our STAR program, which is receiving national recognition, but we just received an award from our International Trade Association this year for our STAR efforts, is to basically take a look at the total sustainability of the airport, which would include our environmental programs, air, water, and noise, our complete financial model of how we are sustaining ourselves over the long haul, how we make decisions on the airport to improve the facility to meet future growth demands and so forth, and minimize the economic and environmental consequences in the community. Let me give you some examples of some of our successes. When we, for example, expanded the parking, the structural parking in our terminal buildings, both at Humphrey and then when we built the Humphrey facilities new, and when we expanded the facilities at Lindbergh, when we built the new parking ramp, of course, that's substantial lighting that's required, and we really do like to light up our structure because there are so many cars, and quite honestly, light limits and discourages criminal activity. And as a result, we put brand new light fixtures in that were significantly more energy efficient in the new addition, the new 10,000 parking spaces. As part of that project, we built into the cost of the new parking structure complete relighting of all the light fixtures in the old structure, and significantly enhanced the overall lighting and the desirability of the facility, and also cut the overall energy cost of the old facility, which quite frankly was more than the new combined facilities altogether. We recently transitioned our power systems at the airport. We now have the ability to use fuel oil, to use jet fuel or natural gas to power our electrical systems in the airport, our heating and air conditioning systems in the airport, so we can choose and bid on various energy sources to seek out the lowest overall cost of energy as we heat the building in the wintertime or cool the buildings in the summertime. We, for example, capture the glycol that's used to de-ice airplanes on the airport, and we have five brand new ramps. These are areas where aircraft taxi to and stop to be de-iced in the wintertime. These are 20-acre parcels, about $20 to $25 million each. And what they're designed to do is obviously provide a surface for de-icing and for aircraft to do their pre-flight checks before departure. But when they're being de-iced, we capture all the de-icing fluid, drive it into and push it into and melt it into this underground system, which transports the water and the glycol content to a 3 million gallon holding basin on the airport, where it is then slowly either transitioned to the Waste Control Commission for proper processing, or is pumped and taken to a recycling facility where we are compensated for recycling those glycol, the glycol fluids and so forth. And by the way, the fluids once used cannot be used in aviation again, but the de-icing material can be used as antifreeze for automobiles. And so when you sell, or when someone pumps that $3 million pond, that 3 million gallon pond of de-icing fluid and water and runoff and all the other stuff that's accumulated in the ramp area, they can remanufacture that, clean it, and market it and sell it as vehicle antifreeze. Those are just a couple of the off-the-top things that we have done over the years, and we do track that, and we do try to monitor our progress in this area.
Representative Hornstein. One quick follow-up then, Jim. So let's just take electric consumption. Can you quantify savings, let's say, from 2006 to 2007 to 2008 in terms of, you know, how many kilowatt hours or whatever. You know, is that information accessible and available? This is a huge issue, just looking at different sectors, both in terms of reducing our dependence on oil and greenhouse gas emissions. I think the airport can play a very important role in that. And so are you able to quantify and then track all of this, and is it publicly available?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weinstein, I won't give you a definitive yes because I don't know about 2008 and 2007, but I know that it was a couple of years ago that the MAC was one of the parties that bid on acquiring and purchasing the Ford Motor Company Dam on the Mississippi River. We did that for the specific purpose of maximizing non-environmental impacting energy sources for the airport. And while we were not successful in our bid to acquire the Ford Dam to generate power for the airport, the bottom line is that's an example of our continued effort. And when we did that analysis and we submitted our bid for that project, we did do an analysis of what our energy consumption was at that time. And I'm certain that comparisons can be made year to year on how we've improved over the course of time.
Yeah, I was disappointed, Mr. Chair, in that. I thought that should have stayed in the public sector, but, you know, whatever. So thank you. I will continue to work with you and your staff on this. I think it's important, and I'd like to get a little better grasp of it, of how you're doing, and we'll continue to do, we hope, in the future on this energy savings issue.
I'd be happy to share information and work with you in the future.
Mr. Hamill, I got one more question here, and then there's another one here also, but I've been getting a lot of calls or emails regarding the Anoka County Airport and possibility of expanding that. You said it's that 5,000-foot runway now, and there's some people concerned about it being expanded to a 6,000. What can you tell me about the MAC plans about that?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Mr. Chairman, that we just finished a major construction project a year and a half ago, lengthening it from 4,000 to 5,000 feet. That basically was an incentive to accommodate further private investment on the airport, and we also partnered with Anoka County in a very precedent-setting partnership between MAC, the county, Anoka County, and the private sector. And it's demonstrated, I think, quite frankly, a viable plan to provide improved, high-quality aviation services in the northern suburban communities. As far as expansion of the runway, there are numerous players that have to be involved in that kind of a decision. Of course, the state legislature sets the criteria for the types of airports that we are authorized to develop. The Metropolitan Council has oversight here as to the specific role and location of airports in the community. Any change in the role of an airport from a minor to an intermediate or intermediate to an air carrier airport, we have to go through an extensive process both within the state legislature and at the Metropolitan Council. And also, finally, and probably significantly so, the Federal Aviation Administration has to get involved in this process as well. There would be an entire environmental impact process we would have to go through. It would require extensive public hearings, public testimony, cost-benefit analysis. And those types of studies require not months, but years and years of documentation and preparation. We believe that if the community believes there's a need to expand the facility, that it should go through a proper public process, that all the proponents and opponents should have their say, and that a public body should make a determination of what the needs are and where that project should move forward. I think MAC has a long history of being involved in highly visible, publicly accessible debate and controversial issues. And in the future, if there's a demand or a need for a 6,000-foot runway, it should go through that public process of appropriate vetting. At this point, the Commission does not have an official position regarding the lengthening of that airport and its runway.
So it's not going to happen next week.
It's not going to happen soon.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the discussion sort of leads on to a more general question that I had. Mr. Hamill, what assumptions does the Commission make about the possibility of growth or the lack thereof in air travel, MFT, and more generally for aviation in the next 20 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, that's a very thoughtful question. In that, if you divide aviation into its various segments, that is, airline passengers, corporate aviation, and recreational and private flying, each of those sectors have kind of a different sort of a forecast for a future. Taking a look at the air carrier industry itself, as you know, we've all watched this extraordinary roller coaster ride since the airline industry was deregulated in 1978. And as a result, we've seen the bankruptcy of 173 airline companies as of last week. over the last 30 years. That industry will continue to be highly volatile. We are quite frankly comfortable and comforted by the merger of Delta and Northwest. Saddened by the loss of a tail, the color tail, the red tail, being in Minneapolis-St. Paul and kind of our international recognition as being the world headquarters of the fifth largest airline in the country. But at the end of the day, this consolidation that took place has permitted Delta the opportunity to put the synergy together to have Delta become a long-term, lasting survivor of this very competitive process. So on the airline side, what we see is continued reductions in capacity by all the airline companies, including Delta. We think Minneapolis-St. Paul is pretty well bottomed out, as I said earlier today, and we're not going to see any significant declines in the near future. What I do think we'll see as the economy stabilizes over the next year to year and a half is a leveling off, and then as Delta begins to grow and as they begin to put the pieces together to become a more efficient, more competitive airline worldwide, we'll see all of its hubs, including Minneapolis-St. Paul, begin to grow again. As the economy recovers, we'll also see companies like Sun Country, Southwest Airlines, AirTran, all the airlines that serve the Twin Cities also begin to grow slowly, but we envision Minneapolis-St. Paul as continuing to be an important, significant hub for Delta Airlines with improved and increased domestic and international air service. So we see the airport as stable and growing from this point forward. On the corporate aviation side, a year ago, if you'd asked me that question, or even 6 months ago, I would have told you that corporate aviation is booming. There are more corporate jet aircraft on order for delivery over the next 3 years. You couldn't buy a corporate jet 6 months ago without waiting for 2 or 3 years for delivery on a $30 to $50 million product. Today, that has slowed dramatically as corporations begin to reevaluate their financial position, and as a result, we're seeing some slowing of corporate aviation deliveries and sales. And I think that will continue until the market stabilizes. It's just one of the first things that goes in the corporate infrastructure is the corporate jet or jets and the pilots in the aviation division. At the end of the day, however, aviation is an important part of business in America and worldwide. 3M Company uses their aircraft to fly nonstop from downtown St. Paul to places like Moscow and Tokyo nonstop out of the Twin Cities. They don't do that because it's nice to have. They do it because it generates economic vitality and keeps 3M Company competitive in the world marketplace. We have 19 Fortune 500 corporations in the Twin Cities, and while there may be a bit of a lull and a little bit of a stagnation, we at the airport are building facilities on our airports to accommodate future hangar growth and future aircraft sales to accommodate the growth of aviation in the Twin Cities. The third area, which is general aviation, small business operators, is in a state of real decline. And we see on our reliever airports diminishing numbers of small private operator airplanes and the increase of corporate activity, although that's somewhat stabilizing right now and stagnating. I think we won't see significant growth over the next year or year and a half. If I look toward the future at aviation, I would tell you that we're still projecting that by the year 2025 or so, we're going to grow from the current 35 million passengers to somewhere approaching 50 million passengers a year. We're going to continue to see the delivery of corporate aviation and corporate airplanes as more and more companies rely on private travel to conduct their business to destinations not served by airline companies. And we'll probably see a leveling off of the purchase of private airplanes for recreational purposes. That will not be a dynamic, high-growth area in the future. That's kind of my personal observation as I've studied the industry over the last 30 years or so.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess a follow-up on Representative Hilty's question, Mr. Hamill. With all due respect, how is that possible to go from 35 million passengers to 50 million by 2020 with the skies being congested? And then, I mean, there's no question. We need to maintain our status as a vibrant international hub, but as soon as the economy starts to come close to recovering, that there's any hints of real economic activity, we're going to see oil quickly jump to 100 and then probably 120, 150, and I don't think $200 a barrel is going to be out of the question. You know, hopefully with by 2010, 2011, we'll have that activity that's going to, a single international crisis will jump it to $200 a barrel, and people will, I don't see airlines being able to attract leisure travel. Business travel is a very different piece, but I'm just curious how that, I mean, in terms of the assumptions that lead to that growth, there's so many competing factors there. Can you reconcile any of them for us?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try. You're right. It's a very, very complex model, and there are all sorts of different dynamics taking place simultaneously. I think one of the basic questions we have to ask ourselves is, do we think that we see aviation as stagnating for the foreseeable future, that is, the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years? Have we already reached the peak and this is an industry in decline? The answer is the world economy is not going to permit that to happen. China alone will overpower the United States and generate more aviation air traffic than the United States has today in the next 15 to 20 years. I mean, China has more cities of greater than 2 million people than any of all the other cities in the world combined. And as a result, there's dramatic demand for transportation in other parts of the world, and I believe the United States is going to be part and a participant in that world economy. Fuel at $140 a barrel, at $200 a barrel, I quite frankly don't know what's going to happen in that model. But I will tell you that as the industry continues to grow, and it's the only way, unless you believe in telecommunications as being kind of the end-all to the need for people to communicate with one another, to make business decisions and conduct business activity, travel will remain an important part of the daily activities of commerce and economy. And as a result, I think we'll see some growth. By the way, that 50 million is 3% growth per year, which is the growth rate that we've had since 1945. So that is not an exaggerated or an extraordinary projection. It simply looks at growth with various stagnations in the process of the various economic cycles we go through. How do you transport 50 million passengers at an airport that has four runways and currently is very busy during the peak hours of 8 a.m. and 5 p.m.? You take the 40-passenger regional jet, and as the traffic grows, you replace it with an 80-passenger regional jet that's replaced with a 120-passenger full-size commercial jet that's replaced with a 150-passenger airplane. And what you end up doing is seeing significant increases in passenger activity, but not necessarily dramatic growth in the overall operations of the aircraft. You see an upstage or upgrading of the gauge, that is, the types of airplanes and the capacity of airplanes, and you simply have larger airplanes flying to destination points with more people on board. And that's kind of been our history over time. We've had an unusual burp in air transportation with the advent of the regional jets, but I believe that they're temporary and will ultimately be relegated to smaller communities in the future and not major connecting aircraft between major cities.
Any more questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Hamill. And
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Committee members, I'm sorry for talking so much. I hope that you answered your questions. If any more questions for us, please feel free to contact us or Ms. Killian, who's our representative here at the legislature while you're here, for any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Sterner, a minute.
Mr. Chair, I've reviewed the minutes, and they looked very well done, and so I'd like to make a motion to approve them.
All in favor? Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Discussion? All opposed? Aye, got it. Thank you. That concludes our business. That concludes our business today, and meeting adjourned.